I'm listening to the show every morning, and you can say it's grand. It's not grand if you're not on it, though.
OTB's Mount Rushmore.
Some talent in Cork, isn't there? Wow. A few of the GAA boys weren't happy, but it was my sporting hero. I was contesting, I think, against Jimmy Barry Murphy. So once you're in that company, everything is good.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
It's very, very special. Believe me, I think it becomes more special when you're on the couch, because it's something, unfortunately, inside me that's ultra competitive, and I need to be there.
Catch the live decision-making over the next few months on OTB AM on the OTB Podcast Network. The OTB Podcast Network.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
Now, this week on our Sunday evening rugby chat, delighted to welcome former Munster and Connacht out half and fullback as well. Heineken Cup winner and a couple of Celtic leagues as well on top of that. All the way from Australia, from Brisbane, Paul Warwick. Thanks a million for joining us. Good evening where you are. It's good morning here in Dublin.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show, Neil.
I said there at the top, out half, a bit of fullback. I wasn't even really sure what position to call you, because I suppose anything outside scrum half, you could probably have filled in and done a job in from time to time.
Yeah, it certainly was both frustrating and I guess a blessing, depending on the team I was in. And but it certainly helped me, secure a foothold, especially in the Munster team, to be so versatile.
You've been back in Australia now the last few years since retirement. What have you been up to? I understand a bit of coaching, is it?
Yeah, so when I arrived back, I took a coaching job at a school, coaching some first 15 rugby, and also started a secondary teaching degree, which I completed last year. So I'm now a qualified teacher at the school I had the rugby coaching job at, and very happy. And it's a good pathway forward for me.
And so what are you teaching then?
Physical education. Qualified in physical education and geography.
Very good, very good. And is this, I presume, coaching rugby as well at the school? Is this, I think a lot of us over here would probably identify a lot with the school system in Australia. There does seem to be a lot of similarities. It's a big rugby schools culture over in Australia. Is the school you're involved in a school where there is a lot of rugby played?
Absolutely. I coach in the Premier rugby competition for schoolboys in Queensland. My school, unfortunately for me, is very academic, so therefore we struggle to compete at the top end. But nonetheless, playing the long game as a teacher and a coach, I do get to work with some talented individuals through some bursaries and scholarships that we bring into the school, but probably just not enough to be competitive of the likes of St Michael's and some of the others in Dublin that I had the fortune of visiting on my last trip back to Ireland last year. So that was really nice.
And is this a little bit similar to Ireland over in Australia, that the kind of core of the top end Australian rugby players are coming out of the school system rather than playing clubs when they're younger?
Definitely. It's definitely a school-based system over here rather than club. But what we're finding is a lot of rugby league kids are probably more talented at an early age. Therefore, they end up at our schools through the bursaries and therefore don't feed straight into that I guess your equivalent AIL club season and go on to, say, a NRL pathway in rugby league instead. So it certainly has hindered the growth of the game over here, but in the same breath, you could argue that Rugby Australia haven't done enough to keep the talent that the schools can bring in and attract through their education and offerings. And I guess it's very similar to your Leinster Schools Cups and things like that. There's a lot of hype around Schoolboy Rugby Union, and a very prestigious competition. Therefore, you'd think the governing body would sort of cash in on that and try and keep some of those really good rugby league kids in the game. But unfortunately, they don't have the money to compete with the NRL clubs.
And from a personal point of view then, are you happy to do the teaching and the coaching for a while, or is the coaching something that down the line you're kind of looking to move more into professionally?
To be honest with you, I would love to. I enjoy coaching. I enjoy working in really good environments with talented people. But having moved around, starting in Ireland, moving to France, and then finishing in England, now resettling in Australia, I couldn't do it to my family. The lifestyle's too volatile. It's one of those things. I would love the job, but too volatile for a family and a non-sporting wife, put it that way.
It's a good answer. It's a very good answer. Is it something then potentially, when the kids are older, when they're away at, when they've moved off to college and when they've kind of gone off doing their own things in life, is it something that you might potentially try look at a little bit further down the line?
Definitely not in Australia. That would only occur probably coming back to Ireland, I would imagine, or Europe. Never say never. As I said, it's a wonderful environment to play work in. I'd really enjoy it. So, at the moment, teaching and keeping the family settled. We've been back in Australia. It's our fifth year. So that's a really strong priority for me, to have my 10-year-old daughter grow up with a group of friends. I have a stepdaughter who's now 20. And unfortunately, through my rugby career, she was moved around a bit. And it was unsettling and probably a bit unfair on her. And try not to make that mistake again in the immediate future anyway.
I suppose the issue of the traveling is probably a nice way to kind of start off, because you did probably do a lot of it early on in your career. You would have been down playing for the Manly club in Sydney, and then obviously on the Seven circuit for a couple of years as well before ultimately coming to Connacht. Tell us about the Connacht move. How did that all come together? That was the first trip into Ireland.
It was. So Andrew Farley, who was ended up being a captain at Connacht, he was a year above me at school in Australia, and inquired about what I was doing. And one thing led to another. I sent some tapes over or whatever was the go in the day, and ended up meeting Michael Bradley at Twickenham when we played in the London IRB Sevens tournament there. And I think it was a month or 2 months later, I was in Galway for race week and then starting the season.
Race week, that's a nice introduction to Galway, right at the top of the season. That's the best way to get used to Galway as a city, I think.
I was shocked. I couldn't believe it. I was like, is it like this every weekend? But obviously they cleared out and I'd signed and sealed, delivered by then. So, I really enjoyed my time at Connacht. It was tough initially with the transition with the weather and things like that. But beautiful city, lots of good people. Rugby-wise, frustrating. When at that time it wasn't what it is now. It was more a feeder club to the Leinsters, Munsters and Ulsters. But it gave me a really good grounding. I was there 3 years and it gave me a really good grounding in Europe. And I came over and I was trying to run the ball from everywhere and do some crazy things, which worked some days and didn't work other days. So you were a hero and villain. But, initially competing for a position with Eric Elwood, who was finishing his career, and then playing with, lots of good players that, as I said at the start, went off and had great careers at Leinster, Munster and Ulster as well. So
Like, as you said there, Connacht at the time, very much the fourth province in Irish rugby. Mm. But I think, as you also kind of said, probably an excellent breeding ground and a place for you to really, really kind of learn the ranks in pro rugby, having come off the Seventh Circuit. Mm. I would say, coming from the Seventh Circuit to playing at the sports ground every week, two completely different worlds altogether.
Oh, absolutely. Funnily enough, my first game was against Newcastle Falcons and Johnny Wilkinson, and that whole roadshow came to Galway. So, it was a great time. Definitely learning the fact that the European season has two seasons within it. So when you can throw the ball around at the start of the year and probably from about April, but the rest is pretty conservative and a bit of a hard slog. And with Connacht, as you said, the fourth province, I can remember going out and goal kicking on the dog track and being kicked off because the dogs were running. So it really put the priority heavily in favour of the dogs rather than the rugby players back then.
Yeah, I'd say so. Like, interesting there, you're kind of saying there are two seasons in the kind of Northern Hemisphere season, the start of the season where you have the nice weather and the tail end of the season where it's good. And right, that the bulk of the season really in between where the weather's poor and all that. How much did you have to kind of alter your game when you arrived in to kind of adjust to that? And did it take a little bit of time for you to actually figure out, okay, I can't just kind of play the Australian way here for a full season?
Yeah, it did take a bit of time. I don't know whether I was just quite brazen or not, but you know, growing up in Australia, you don't kick the ball a lot. And then seeing the best player in Ireland and probably the best 10 in Europe at the time, Ronan O'Gara, just phenomenal positioning of the ball. And I guess from watching a lot of rugby and seeing how opponents such as Johnny Wilkinson and guys I got to play against controlled the game, that was my biggest learning coming from southern to Northern Hemisphere. You know, you're reliant on the forwards a lot more. If you don't have go forward, it's a tough day at the office. Hence why Munster at the time were a real presence in Europe, and Leinster ended up being, you know, a real strong team based on their forward dominance. And you know, at Munster, having a lot of young people trying to challenge the likes of your Leo Cullens at Leinster at the time and your Paul O'Connells at Munster, it was tough playing behind a pack like that. So, you know, you threw it around, and if it come off, it looked good. And if it didn't, yeah, you probably wore, or I probably wore a lot of the blame for the result. So, you know, you win some, you lose some, but I think it all worked out in the end for me.
Talking about Munster then, was that a move that, did Munster come calling or did you go seeking them out?
I had had conversations. Tony McGann was, I think he came in 2006, sort of halfway through that 2005-2006 year that they won it the first time. He was a high school teacher of mine. And I had, you know, lots of dealings with him over the years, and met him after one of the games against Munster, and had a brief conversation. And as I say, I sort of, by that third year at Munster, I was starting to work out the European scene. And when I arrived, and you know, I was playing a bit of footy, and I couldn't understand why people would be content sitting on the bench at Munster or Leinster and not come to Connacht to challenge your starting players for Ireland. That was just something that I couldn't compute with, and until I went to Munster, and you're in an environment that's challenging and it's demanding, and it really draws the best out of you. So it was a challenge that I wanted to be involved in big games. By that third season at Munster, I think I'd played in a Challenge Cup final series with Connacht, of which Sale tore us apart. And then just getting a taste of those games and seeing what Munster had achieved, it was something that I wanted to be a part of. And funnily enough, my wife now, who I met in Galway, was from Cork, or from Mallow, just out of Cork. And whilst she didn't want to move back home, it was sort of a natural fit that we went to Limerick and had 4 great years there.
Mm-hmm. And going in the door then, the changing room door at Munster, how quickly did it take you to get up to speed with what they were doing there? Like, did you notice there was a gulf between Connacht and Munster that you had to adjust to?
Massive. So I vomited in my first weight session at Munster. I can remember it at UL. And then my wife's family were holidaying in France at the time. So I was staying in Mallow while our house was settling in Limerick. And I was stuck upstairs. I'd gone to bed and I couldn't walk the next day. My legs were that sore from just the first weight session. And it was something that wouldn't happen at Connacht, sorry. So yeah, it was an interesting introduction to Munster. What I will say is that the people, success was bred through hard work, and it was just something that I really needed at that point in my career, just to be surrounded by people that wanted to work hard. And I'm talking about, you know, Jerry Flannery's, Marcus Horan's, Ian Dowling's, guys that were fantastic players in their own right, but probably weren't superstars, but just worked really hard to maximize their performance. And it certainly helped me. And I think it's still helping a few of the people that are there today.
And I think in your first season at Munster, they probably, as a team, they probably actually did have something to prove, having won the Heineken Cup in 2006, 2007 had been a real letdown of a year, and to come back in 2007 and 8, there definitely was a bit of pressure and a point to prove, I would say, within that team to go on and do what they did and actually get the Heineken Cup back again.
Yeah, I think the year I came, Ruatapoki came as well, and Doug Howlett joined in January, I think, of 2008. So they weren't missing a lot. And, you know, having not been there before, I can't comment on what went wrong in that season. But I distinctly remember a meeting where Declan Kidney was speaking about this group of players deserved a lot more than just one title. So there was a strong belief that obviously they'd done it in 2006 and broken that barrier down, and a real hunger to get back to those winning ways. Frustratingly enough, well, we won it that year, but the 2 semi-finals, they were tough losses in 2009 and 10.
Mm-hmm. On 2008, I imagine a pretty special feeling to be involved in that Heineken Cup success. I know you didn't actually, you know, get on to play in the final against Toulouse, but you were in the match day squad and part of that season as well.
Yeah, best seat in the house. I think in that Heineken Cup season, I probably played about 30 minutes in total. So, whilst I certainly wanted to play, it was fantastic exposure and definitely springboarded me for that 2009 season. Just so hungry. I want to be on the field. I have to be on the field. I want to be a part of it, and I want to influence outcomes of games rather than, you know, walking back in the sheds and you know, celebrating other people's success, if you like.
Yeah, and as you referenced earlier, like, there was a fairly formidable character wearing the number 10 shirt for Munster when you arrived. Mm. A fairly established figure in Roland O'Gara. And, you know, you had kind of said there you couldn't understand players kind of settling to be on the bench. When you were going to Munster, had you in your mind, did you have this idea in your head that you could, that you wanted to displace Roland O'Gara out of a 10 shirt, that you could do it? Or were you going there to kind of to further the career, to learn more about yourself as a player?
What if I said both? What was I? I think I was 27. Yeah, about 27. So, I was a bit naive to think that I could displace him. Certainly wasn't anywhere near the level that I needed to be to displace him. I can honestly say that. Very different game plans, obviously, that suited me and suited him. But I definitely, working with someone who pushes themselves every session and is so dedicated to his craft and demands so much out of people, I probably learnt more in that first year than all of my rugby prior. Just in relationships, talking to people, standards, and controlling games. Ronan, whilst we weren't very close, he was very good to me, and it made me a better player because I guess he obviously didn't want to be displaced, and it would have been, you know, probably a big call for someone at Munster to you know, have their number 10 or the Irish number 10 sitting on the bench. Certainly, as time grew, I didn't go to Munster to be a fullback, that's for sure. I went there as a number 10 and solely as a 10 and wanted to challenge Ronan as best I could, I guess.
And you mentioned fullback. Ultimately, it's kind of fullback where I would say a lot of the Munster fans probably have some of their best memories of you. Mm-hmm. Because the following season was where they really started to see you at fullback. Mm-hmm. Was that something that... Tony McGahan, who would have been the head coach at that stage, taking over from Declan Kidney, was he approaching you to kind of say, you know, I know you're able to do a job here for me at fullback, or did you kind of come to him and say, I want to be more involved in the first 15, I'll play wherever you want me to play?
Yeah, I can't off the top of my head remember exactly what happened. I may have got some time in some league games there and sort of done enough. I know Declan gave me some opportunities in my first year at fullback, and I definitely didn't set the world alight there. Sean Payne and Dennis Hurley were probably the two main fullbacks then. But I remember playing a game in the Heineken Cup against Sale. It was probably my first big opportunity at fullback.
That was the away game, wasn't it?
So whilst I was very nervous, I think I did a couple of nice things, and I didn't play it. I played the return game, but I didn't play against the back-to-back Claremont games. I think they went with Barry Murphy in the centre and moved someone around. I can't remember, but that gave me a real taste for it, and I guess by the end of that season, I think that's when we played the Ospreys in the quarterfinal, and I had a very good game. That sort of really helped me cement the spot for a short period of time. What I bought at fullback was probably allowed guys like Lafimi Mafi and Keith Earls and Doug and Ian Dowling, just that second ball player where we could play with a bit more width and accuracy, a second kicking option at fullback. So it gave us a lot of versatility, and you'd know from watching us back then, we were probably the smallest back line in Europe, but very effective through Murphy's strength as a little fella and Keith Earls' speed. And obviously Doug was a huge threat on one of the wings, and Ian Dowling never let anyone down. So whilst we weren't a very big back line, I think just the skill sets of each player has really complemented each other and allowed us to be quite expansive that year.
Yeah, like it's something you see a lot of now in modern rugby, where teams have kind of two first receivers, two ball players out on the pitch. You look at England in particular, a great example of it with Owen Farrell and George Ford. For Munster to be doing that at the time, having Ron Nogara 10 and yourself at fullback, it obviously created difficulty for a lot of teams, because you mentioned the Ospreys game there, that quarterfinal where you had man of the match. obviously they were in a situation where they kicked it long a couple of times straight into your hands, and you had those two monster drop goals that everyone remembers from, I think was one of them maybe inside your own half or just inside their half as well. And, you know, that creates the danger, yeah, roughly, the uncertainty. Yeah. It's, you know, there's no safe space to be kicking a ball loose.
Yeah, it certainly became a threat that if teams did kick loose, I potentially could punish them. But it was just a really good time to play, playing with that carefree attitude, I guess a bit of arrogance, where you go on the field and you just expect to win and you're out there to compete, and our forward pack was doing their job. That was one of the major factors at Munster at the time, is if you did your job as best you could, you know, the people around you would do the same, and it sort of gave us a bit of success and confidence, certainly not complacency, but just that arrogance that you go on the field and you expect to win. It was really exciting to be a part of.
The semi-final against Leinster in 2009, you'd mentioned it, that, you know, 2009 and 10, those semi-finals were incredibly tough to take. Was the team that lost to Leinster in 2009, was that group of players, that squad over the season, I don't know, I would have thought it personally previously, were you a better team that season than the one that actually won it the previous year and just ultimately came unstuck against an unbelievable Leinster team?
Yeah, I mentioned it earlier, the forwards, I don't know what Michael Checker did, and I won't give him all the credit, but certainly in that game, we just couldn't get a foothold that we were used to, I guess, in the pack. It's easy to throw the ball around, but you need to have impacted the defensive line through your forward play and I guess manipulated some defenders, so you're creating space, and it just didn't happen for us. And even to the extent in that game, I think Felipe Contepomi was injured very early on, and Sexton got his chance and obviously had a fantastic career from there. But, you can't put your finger on it. I think it was 20-something to 6 or something like that. I think I've tried to forget the score, but you just never felt in the game. We were never in control and just didn't get the bounce of the ball on the day. Certainly, that was the best rugby we'd played and probably did play in my time at Munster. And, one of those days where it didn't go, and it just happened to be at Crow Park in front of heaps of people, unfortunately.
That day was probably right in the middle of, I'd say, maybe like the 10-year period where that Munster-Leinster rivalry was absolutely at its peak, because when they used to play each other, unfortunately, where it is now, where you have a lot of the Irish internationals are being rested for those games because they're falling in the Christmas period, but you would have had a lot of them maybe before the big Heineken Cup weekends, where all the stars were going to be out there, and it was absolutely hell for leather between those two sides.
Definitely. I'm sure everyone did it, but if you got named for that team, that was like getting named for a Heineken Cup game. You knew where you sat in the pecking order if you were playing against Leinster. They were phenomenal games and always tight. I guess that semi-final loss springboarded Leinster to probably 5 or 6 games where they beat us in a row, which maybe not 5, but close enough. But that was a really changing of the guard moment. And those games were ferocious, and it was fantastic to be a part of.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people forget maybe the 2010 season. It kind of seems to fade from a lot of people's memories because it wasn't probably as high profile a defeat as the Leinster game was, and, you know, ultimately not winning it. But getting to the semi-final, again, it was a Munster team that were firing on all cylinders for much of the season. Like the absolutely, that very, very famous win against Northampton, the, you know, winning that 5-meter scrum under your own post, and then absolutely demolishing the Northampton Saints then again in the quarterfinals, but just so flat against Biarritz in the semis.
Yeah, it's really bizarre. That was one of the toughest weeks in my life. My daughter was born, and she has she was born with cystic fibrosis. So I didn't train all week. I was up in Dublin. So she was born on a Wednesday, so I was out till then. And then was taken up to Dublin on the Thursday to Crumlin. So I was sort of commuting and trying to train and be with my family. And I flew out to Biarritz, I think, late. And it was up in the air whether I was going to play. But, yeah, it was just, I don't know, again, John de Villiers was part of the team. So we weren't lacking talent. Biarritz were a scrappy team. Obviously, I think Yashvili kicked, I don't know, 6 or 7 penalties and they didn't score a try against us. So it was a frustrating loss. Keith Earls, I think, scored very early. And just one of those games that didn't flow probably how we expected, or we didn't do enough early to put them away to keep them out of reach with penalties.
Mm-hmm. I'll stop talking about disappointments now in the... for Munster. I'll talk about a good day in particular. Well, a couple of good days. One did end in defeat. The All Blacks game, the Australia game. I imagine for you personally, though, the Australia one was a pretty sweet one, kicking all those points in the wind and the rain in Thoma Park on that that midweek night. I was speaking to James Collin on the show last week, who obviously captained the team that evening as well, and he was talking about just there were quite a few of those Australian players who weren't really prepared for not just the team itself, but the weather conditions in Limerick on that night.
Yeah, it was horrendous conditions. But yeah, it was really, really sweet to having never played for the Wallabies, to play against my friends and people I grew up with, and to beat them. You know, it wasn't the Australian team, obviously, but a second string. But what makes it better is the amount of academy guys we had in our team. I think there was only three or four frontline Munster players in that team that won. And again, it's probably a tribute to my education of European rugby as opposed to, you know, Beric Barnes and the halves that played for Australia that night. Playing the conditions, and I think we went into the gale to start with and led at halftime, or it was 6-6 at halftime or something like that. And the game was in the bag. There was no way they were going to beat us at halftime. So, yeah, really, really pleasing, entertaining nights. Personally, a lot of self-satisfaction to sort of stick one up my countrymen, I guess. A very enjoyable night.
You mentioned like the academy guys in the team at that stage. Like, I remember that night, Peter O'Mahony would have played that night. He was absolutely fantastic. I think Conor Murray came off the bench as well. And I can't remember whether or not Keith Earls was involved. He could have been involved with the Irish team that week, but he was a few years into his Irish career as well. And you know, these are the three guys who were at the very early stages of their career at that, around that time, but ultimately have pretty much been the backbone of this Munster team for the last decades. Could you see things in them when they were at that age that, you know, what was it about those kind of kids? I think Peter O'Mahony in particular, there was always this reputation that he was kind of, he did have this kind of wisdom above his ears.
Yeah, I think what Pete had very young was just that competitive nature. You know, he's sort of an old school rugby player, if you like, in a modern era in terms of, he would have thrived in those days with Claw and where they were kicking the crap out of each other at training, and to a lesser extent when, you know, Alan Quinlan's and Mick O'Driscoll's and all those guys were competing for positions with, you know, David Wallace's and Paul O'Connell's, John Hayes, all these guys. So Pete got a fantastic apprenticeship watching these guys at training every day. He also was probably tarred with the leadership brush very early, which obviously helps just in how he composed himself and how he was sort of thought by his peers. So that certainly was a feather in his cap at the time. Connor Murray is another one who, you know, personally at the time, I wouldn't have said, wouldn't have thought Connor would have got to the heights that he did. So fantastic player, and his composure and how he can control a game at nine is a real credit to him. Personally, when I look back on my time there, playing with Tomaso Leary was fantastic because I loved playing with someone who was a threat. I wouldn't say Connor's a massive attacking threat, but how he can control a game in that manner is fantastic with his kicking and his pace of the game.
Mm-hmm. That was obviously your final season with Munster that summer of 2011. You moved down to Stade Francais. I might bring it back to a couple of years previous when you almost did leave London Irish. There'd been London Irish had said there was a signature on a piece of paper. They were saying you changed your mind. Ultimately, all parties agreed and worked things out, and you stayed in Munster for another couple of seasons. What happened with that London Irish move at the time?
I signed with London Irish and I was fully committed to going. There was lots of back and forth with, I suppose I've got to take you right back. When I first came to Ireland to play with Connacht, it was under the pretense that I could qualify and potentially play for Ireland. So I did my 3 years. I think at the time it was 3 years and then you could qualify. But I fell into a bit of a void because I'd played Australian sevens, which categorised me as essentially playing for the Wallabies without, obviously in Australia, it was ranked below the under 21s, if you like, or under 20s, what it is now, in terms of pecking order. So Lifemi Mafi fell into the same boat with the Maori, also the New Zealand sevens as well. Ireland were at the time looking at limiting how many foreign players they could have, and I was sort of on the cusp of getting, I wanted a longer term deal. I think I'd turned 29 at the time, and I was looking for a 2 or 3 year deal, and they could only give me a 1 year contract. So I had a young family and wanted that stability. So I definitely signed, did the whole thing. And it was a pretty tough phone call to make because Munster came back and said, look, RFU have relaxed the rules. You can stay if you want to. I remember Paul O'Connell coming around to the house to persuade me as well. And of course I wanted to stay. I love the place. And you know, we've spoken about a lot of the fun memories that I've had there. I said, I'm in, I want to stay. And I had to call Toby Booth at London Irish and didn't kind of go as expected. I sort of let him know that I wouldn't be joining the team. And he sort of disagreed and said, I expect to see you on day one when we start pre-season training. Then I sort of backed out of that. I'd made the phone call and said my piece. And I think Garrett Fitzgerald, who was fantastic to me and my family at the time, stepped up and took over negotiations. And, you know, I don't know the ins and outs of the deal. But, yeah, I think London Irish did quite well out of it. So
we'll leave it there. So, and so... 2011 then when you did leave, obviously it was for those same reasons that you weren't qualified to play for Ireland, and ultimately if you're not qualified to play for Ireland, you're kind of surplus to requirements as far as the IRFU concerned. How difficult is that to deal with, because at that stage you have an Irish family, you know, you're settled down in the country, and having to uproot a family to move off to France initially, then England after that. But, you know, particularly I think for someone who has, you know, established an Irish family and has settled down here, I imagine it's incredibly difficult. We would have seen it similar a few years ago with Ruaidh Pienaar and Ulster, for example.
Well, I don't think it was too difficult when I made the decision, or when my wife and I made the decision, she spent a lot of time in France in a holiday home that her parents have down in the south of France. And it's something that I'd always wanted to try every time we'd go with the Heineken Cup or the Challenge Cup when I was at Connacht. It was definitely, a life experience I wanted to try. And having an Australian coach was definitely appealing. If I had my time over, I would take the one-year contract and stay at Munster and fight for that one-year contract year after year. But at the time, it was a three-year deal. It was a lot more money and sort of scratched an itch that I'd wanted to experience for a long time. So all those cards fell into place. It was, I guess, one of those Osprey scenarios. It was a Galactico team that had no substance, just a lot of a lot of very good players that didn't play well together as a team, and a lot of politics as well behind the scenes, which was ultimately Michael Checker's demise. And I sort of got out of there. I saw out 2 years of my three-year contract, and we went to Worcester after that. So it was an experience. If I hadn't have done it, I would have wished I had. So it's one of those things. In hindsight, I probably would have enjoyed, I guess, fighting for my spot with Felix Jones at the time for fullback at Munster.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose before you did leave Munster, you did get to go out on a high, the Magnus League final against Leinster, getting one last trophy. I would say as well, a nice feeling as well, being able to do it with someone you'd mentioned had been a teacher of yours previously, Tony McGahan as well, that, you know, all of a sudden here you are, whatever, 20 odd years later at the other side of the world, lifting a trophy together.
Yeah, definitely. Well, funnily enough, he works probably 300 meters down the road from my school at one of our rival schools at the moment as the director of sport. So,
you've come full circle.
Yeah, it certainly have. It was really nice. Very sad to leave with Paul Derbyshire, who was one of the fitness trainers. At the start of that season, he got motor neuron disease or was diagnosed with motor neurons and deteriorated that year quite rapidly. And I think he was in a wheelchair on stage with us by the end and passed not long after. But it was great. Everyone would prefer to go out a winner, and I was lucky enough to have that send off.
And you've been back to Limerick and Cork and Ireland quite a few times since. Obviously, you've mentioned the Irish family. It's somewhere you go regularly enough. I've seen your Twitter. Your Twitter feed seems to be exclusively reserved for Munster tweets. Just kind of checking in every few weeks or every month or so, and just say something nice about the people in Limerick and Cork, and we'll check back out again.
I get up and watch the games. I think the afternoon games are on early in the morning, but if it's a night game, I get up early here, and it's sort of time fits as my family did when I was playing over there. But yeah, I really miss the place, to be honest. It holds the greatest rugby memories for me when I played. It's a really special place, and my having roots there with now my kids, both being born, or Aira being born in Limerick, and Leah, my stepdaughter. I miss the place, and as I said, it's fond memories.
Well, Paul, listen, it's been absolutely fantastic having you on the show. And thanks a million for taking time out of your evening down in Brisbane. It's been a pleasure having you on. Paul Warwick.
Thank you. Appreciate your time, Neil. Bye.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of Us. Everyone in.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.